You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps show. As always, I'm your host, Lily Elise. Today's episode, we're diving into the cosplay murders. Before we do that, let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And of course, with that, let's dive right into today's case. Excuse me. So I think it's fair to say that we all go through rough patches in life. That's why it's so important to have someone that you can truly lean on and trust. It's a good support system, whether it's a partner, a parent, a sibling, a friend, even a therapist, a dog. We all need someone that we can confide in, someone who is looking out for our best interest, especially when those struggles are mental health related. And I know this sounds like a BetterHelp ad, but it's not. The point I'm trying to make is those lifelines are everything. And when you trust someone with your deepest, darkest secrets, you hope that at the bare minimum, they will never use those secrets you told them against you, which is why you do have to be careful about who you open up to, who you trust in those dark times, because in the wrong hands, our darkest moments could be weaponized against us. And in the event of today's case, could even be used to cover up murder. So let's not that far back to 2015, actually. I just say that and it's about 10 years ago. That's kind of far. But I guess most of our cases are kind of like 90s, even 80s, so it's not really that far when you look back at all our cases. But 2015, why does that feel like 3 years ago? Almost 10 years ago, basically. 22-year-old Matthew Tressler had just moved to Florida from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Now, Matthew's parents, Margaret and David, gave him and his older brother, Sean, a pretty good childhood in Massachusetts. And this is all based on everything that I've read going through this case. But like a lot of kids in their teens, Matthew sort of lost his way for a little while. He had battled with some substance abuse in his earlier years. So when Sean, who is his older brother, mentioned that he would be moving to Florida to start his own construction business, well, Matthew thought it would be a good opportunity and a fresh start for him as well. So he packed up his things and followed his brother 1,300 miles south to Tampa, where he actually worked as Sean's first employee at his new company. And that's when Sean noticed his little brother turn a corner. The sweet kid with a big heart resurfaced as Matt, who's now 22, embraced this new life for himself. Matthew even started thinking about settling down. He created a profile on Tinder, now in Florida, and began swiping. Eventually, he came across one pretty face that caught his eye. 24-year-old girl who loved animals, who went to school for special effects and makeup, an artist who seemed bubbly and kind. Her name was Melissa Turner. The two met up and Melissa said she was immediately taken with Matthew. So Melissa said that Matthew, quote, drew her in, made her feel important. He was different from other guys. From other guys that she had dated in the past. One date turned to another and then another. And before long, as the story goes, the couple was fully committed to one another. Matthew opened up to Melissa about his difficult past, his history with drinking and substance abuse. And Melissa told Matthew about her insecurities, how she had been overweight and bullied through a lot of her childhood, and how she worked hard to go from 250 pounds down to 150 pounds in her early 20s. Melissa had found her confidence through this fitness journey of hers and had really started to come into herself. When Matthew met Melissa, she was dreaming of becoming an actress. Was also, though, very into cosplay. Cosplay is kind of cool, not going to lie. She would dress up like Elma from Scooby-Doo, attend conventions, that sort of thing. And Matthew really did seem supportive of the entire thing. By 2019, the couple was engaged and looking to buy a house together. So they found a place in Riverview, a considerably safe residential suburb of Tampa. They were excited about starting their lives together, spending the weekends picking out paint colors and furniture for their new house. And everyone who knew them as a couple thought, these two are going to go on and live a long, fruitful life together. That was until the fall of that year. So we're now in 2019. Matthew and Melissa have moved in together in Florida. And it was actually October 17th, 2019. It started out like any other day for the couple. Matthew and Melissa ran errands together. They went down to Home Depot, then to a grocery store. Then they had lunch out near their Tampa home. And then they spent the rest of the night. And Melissa said they ended up cooking dinner. They had a few cocktails. And around 11 p.m., she got tired and went to sleep. She passed out, actually. She went to sleep on a big sofa-like chair that she had in her office, Well, she said Matthew was still up and kind of staying up late. But when she woke up the following morning at around 8:30 a.m. on October 18th, 2019, Melissa found their house a complete disaster. The kitchen was completely trashed. There was blood everywhere, and Melissa said she was calling out for Matthew, but she couldn't find him. So she ran out upstairs and searched their bedroom and the bathroom. But still, there was no sign of Matthew, just the house, bloody, and a mess. So this is when she decides to go out into the backyard and look around. And lying on the patio by their pool was Matthew. He was unresponsive and covered in blood, so Melissa calls 911. The operator told her to administer CPR, and a frantic Melissa seemingly followed those instructions, because when EMTs arrived minutes later, she was also covered in blood herself. But it was clear to Melissa that there was no one who could help the situation, because her fiancé, 24-year-old Matthew Tressler, was dead. So now Melissa tells police that, honestly, she was home, but she has no idea what happened. She said she just woke up and found him in this bloody mess. So police ask Melissa if they can search the house. And she's like, yes, go right ahead. They have her sign a consent form, and then they give her these latex gloves to wear, probably so she doesn't touch anything else in her home now that it's an active crime scene. And when they look inside, they find a lot of broken glass, including one piece that has a pretty good amount of blood on it. They also discover a black switchblade that, when flipped open, also has blood on the inside blade. And there's a ridiculous amount of blood in the kitchen. Like, one of the state prosecutors who was at the scene said it was the bloodiest crime scene she had ever witnessed in her career. Well, detectives think that because of how much blood is inside the kitchen, they believe that Matthew probably mostly bled out inside the home and then ended up crawling out of the screen of the window out to the patio. So they're like following the blood, and this is what they think has happened. They also think this because the window appears to be pushed open, which is weird, obviously. So police are wondering, was he trying to get away from someone? Like, why crawl outside if no one else is in the house? Why not crawl to a phone? Because it definitely looks like he was trying to get outside. So the wounds on Matthew's body became even more confusing to detectives. He has multiple lacerations all over him, but the one that looks fatal was actually a deep cut to his right arm. At this point, Melissa agrees to come down to the police station for questioning. This is obviously going to be normal, as she is claiming to be at the crime scene at the time of the crime. And there, she remains adamant that she has absolutely zero idea how this had all happened. I'm just already getting a little, obviously, flags are going up because of how bloody it was. It seems like, I mean, he was obviously stabbed. There's going to be screaming. There's just no way you don't hear anything. There's no way she didn't hear anything. Well, she tells police, she's like, listen, I had a few drinks last night, I passed out, and then genuinely I woke up and found Matthew in that state in the backyard. What I was going to say is there's probably a spot in the room in our house where we could scream and nobody else would hear it. Police are like, okay, yeah, we hear her story. But what was most suspicious to them is that this is a really gruesome crime scene. There were a lot of signs of struggle in the kitchen alone. Broken glass. So how in the world did Melissa sleep through it? Through something like that. And here's what else is strange. In the interview with police, Melissa comes in still wearing those latex gloves that they gave her earlier at the crime scene. Which, okay, but these are like, well, we're no longer at the crime scene, you know? You can take those gloves off now. Like, you don't have to wear those in here. And so eventually, detectives are like, what? Okay, so they interview her with them on. And then they're like, we need to photograph you now. So you're going to have to remove the gloves. And so she takes the gloves off. Well, they realize that under the gloves, she was hiding a pretty big gash on her palm. Yep, like a gash deep enough that it needed stitches. Like, it was bloody, like it needed stitches. And they're like, why didn't you talk about that? What is that? And she says, no, it was just that before I called 911, I went in and I accidentally grabbed one of the broken glasses. But then as police are kind of moving her around to take pictures of her, they discover that's not her only injury. She also has a cut on her neck too. So at this point, police are having a hard time buying Melissa's story. She then decides at this point to press her a little further. They were like, hey, did you guys as a couple ever fight? Did things ever get physical between you? And Melissa's like, no, absolutely not. Things between us were great. But there was one thing Melissa said. Matthew always tried to hide from her when he was sad or depressed. But he had, on more than one occasion, talked about self-harm, according to Melissa. So they ask her, were you guys ever physically violent? She's like, no, but Matthew did hide kind of this violent towards himself side to him. She said he always feared he was going to die young. So now police are considering this and they're like, okay, is she alluding that maybe this was suicide? No, there's no way he could. I guess there's always a way, but also it's not like he was stabbed. They were more slashes, and that wound on his arm would have made this impossible. Like, you can definitely give yourself a fatal wound on your arm, so when police run this scenario against other details found at the crime scene, they're like, it just doesn't add up, because alongside some defensive-looking wounds on Matthew's body, the medical examiner actually finds a stab wound in his back. The medical examiner is like, we don't think he could have stabbed himself in the back. And the evidence that this was actually a homicide keeps growing from here. Remember that big sofa-like chair that Melissa said she slept on in her office that night? Well, when police are still combing through the crime scene, they find blood drops leading to that chair. Okay, so that could have gotten there after Melissa walked around the house that morning, sure. But detectives also find clues that she actually wasn't sound asleep all night, like she had initially told them. Because for starters, police collect all the data from Matthew's smartwatch and learn his exact time of death from his health app on there. Because it's obviously going to track when his heart stopped beating. It registered that Matthew's heart stopped beating sometime close to 5 a.m., which lines up with another really chilling piece of evidence that police had collected while canvassing the neighborhood from one of Melissa and Matthew's neighbors. I mean, I get you can take the watch off and stuff, but if there's a way to differentiate the two, and they can tell your heart actually stopped beating and it's still on you, yeah, it should send a notification to like the non-emergency hotline or something like that, I don't know. So it turns out that the people living across from Melissa and Matthew had a security camera that captured the couple's backyard. Of course they did. So it captures a piece of the backyard. Now the fence around Melissa and Matthew's property keeps you from seeing what's happening out there. But police are like, hey. So police are like, hey, he crawled out to the backyard. He's found dead in the backyard. Can we please see that footage? But those cameras also capture sound. So they're like, ah, we can't see anything, but there's sound. So they turn it up, and around 4 a.m., so an hour before his heart stopped beating on the morning of October 18th, you can definitely hear banging on the neighbor's security camera, coming from inside Matthew and Melissa's home. It sounds like objects are crashing inside the house, as if someone's throwing things around. And then over the next few minutes, voices start to appear on the security camera sound. And by 4:37 a.m., there is screaming coming from Matthew and Melissa's backyard. Now, I want to tell you, it almost sounds demonic. It's a woman shouting things like, I hate you. You're so effing arrogant. Go effing die. And that's followed by more shouting and things like, get up. Get up now. I hate you. And all that screaming and crashing seems to go silent by 5:11 a.m. that morning, which does, again, line up with the data collected from Matthew's smartwatch. So the question of suicide is clearly no longer on the table for detectives, because you can obviously hear that there is a woman threatening Matthew. So they can clearly hear there's two different voices, a woman and a male. So now the question is, was that a third party yelling at Matthew while Melissa was asleep on that chair that had blood drips on it? Or is it Melissa in the video? Now, I do want to tell you, all that footage is actually reviewed while Melissa is still in the interrogation room the morning, day of the murder. So police are working fast on this case. They go and talk to neighbors. They're like, pull it up right now. We need to see. Which reminds me of the Chris Watts case, where literally as soon as police respond, one officer, they go to the neighbor's house and look at like his security footage. How crazy would it be? She's sitting there not knowing, but just being actively caught because a neighbor has a security camera. So detectives go back into the interrogation room and they're like, listen, your neighbor has security footage and we need you to tell us what had happened around 4 a.m. this morning. And Melissa plays dumb for a while. She's like, what happened before? I don't know. I told you I was sleeping. And they're like, the neighbor's security camera can pick up on the noise. There was yelling and screaming coming from your home. What did you say to get out of that? Nothing. And Melissa's like, no, I was asleep. I don't remember. And detectives are like, Melissa, please. Melissa. And eventually, Melissa seems to recall some new detail. She says, well, we might have gotten into an argument, but we weren't like screaming at each other. And if we were, it really wasn't a big deal. So by this point, Melissa's admitted that she is awake at 4 a.m. and that she is arguing with Matthew, which means there was no one else at the house with them. And when they corner her on that, they're like, okay, Melissa, you do understand that if he died at 5 and there was no third party in your home and you were awake, who killed him? And she's like, actually, as you're saying this, more is coming to me. She's like, wait, I do remember something. She says Matthew was still up at 4 in the morning and was being super loud and woke her up. So they got into a fight about it. And When they ask her why she was screaming at him to get up, she says, oh, well, Matthew was clearly not sober on that evening, even though he had been battling with his sobriety for years. And when he got to that state of drunkenness, he would often fall down and have a hard time composing himself. I do want to point out before all this, Matthew was using the fact that Matthew had struggled with his mental health as a way that this could possibly be suicide. Like, maybe the police would think it's suicide if she mentions that he sometimes talked about self-harm or really struggled with this. She kept going along these lines of self-harm, drugs, alcohol. Well, when that doesn't work, now all of a sudden she's weaponizing his addiction. She's like, well, he would just get super drunk and he wouldn't be able to stand up. And so then they're like, okay, whenever we're trying to ask you something, you just revert to somehow it's Matthew's fault. Which, I mean, if she killed him, obviously. So now they're like, okay, now that we've gotten her to kind of reframe her story, change her story already, they say, okay, now can you tell us how you actually got that cut on your hand? Melissa finally gives in. She's like, fine, I did murder Matthew. But it was in self-defense. And she is confessing to the murder of Matthew. But now, the first time she's saying it, I mean, her story has changed 1,000 times. But now it's self-defense. And this is how her confession goes. Melissa says when Matthew woke her up at 4 a.m. because he was being too loud, it did turn into a pretty ugly argument. She said that when Matthew got to this point of intoxication, he was also known to bring out knives. Now again, she sort of returned.
I love my morning coffee, but sometimes the crash hits harder than the caffeine. That's when I switch to Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee infused with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics, giving me smooth, focused energy that actually lasts. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Enter for a chance to win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
This is the first bogus theory she pitched, because she says Matthew was known to turn the knives on himself when they were arguing. And so that evening, the two of them fought over the knife, presumably. This is the black switchblade that was found at the crime scene. Basically, she says she tried to take it away from Matthew when he grabbed her by the neck and started strangling her. Okay, so Melissa said she thought Matthew was going to kill her at that moment, so she grabbed the knife that's now in her possession and stabbed him in the back. Gently, though, she says, I gently stabbed him so that she could try and get him off her. So after this, she said Matthew slammed her head into the counter, and that's when she recalled vaguely stumbling back to her office, where she collapsed in the chair because she now has a head injury, until around 8 a.m. in the morning. Or the next morning, I should say. Then Melissa says when she came to, she was certain Matthew was still alive, because she didn't think that gentle stab wound would be fatal. Mind you, Melissa doesn't really seem to make mention of any other wounds covering Matthew's body, as you remember. But she does say, however, that this wasn't an uncommon occurrence between them, that she had lied earlier, and there was a lot of physical abuse after all. The couple did fight, especially when it came to the addiction that Matthew struggled with, alcohol. But after this, Melissa actually doubles down on this story and comes up with something pretty wild and disturbing. He says not only was there physical abuse, but Matthew saw demons. That sometimes in their relationship, he would stare off in the corners of the house and tell her that evil entities were watching them. I don't really know what to think, because, I mean, Matthew's obviously dead, he can't defend himself, and he's just saying all this stuff. Granted, like, some of the stuff, maybe it could be true, other people, this stuff happens too, but, like, she's just saying stuff, and he can't defend himself. You know what I'm saying? I'm just like, she's just going off, like, she's going off and saying anything and everything possible to make herself look better. Wake up in the morning, call 911, and say, we got in a fight last night, he slammed my head on the counter, I ended up passing out, and now he's dead. Like, it was physical, I don't know what happened, it was self-defense. So she says that when all this happened the night of his murder, Melissa claims that something had switched in Matthew. That it didn't seem like she was even fighting him during this physical altercation. That, as things escalated, according to Melissa, he started talking to her in a weird voice and saying, what's the matter, little girl, are you scared? Because Matt's not here anymore, and he just had this little smile on his face, and he said, what's the matter, little girl, are you scared? Now, I know it might seem like days have passed at this point, but I'm trying to tell you all these story changes and evidence and new things she keeps bringing up happened literally within hours. So by 2 p.m. that day, remember, she calls police, wakes up at 8 a.m. It's now 2 p.m. and all of this has happened. Melissa's like, shoot, should have asked for a lawyer. So they let her leave for the night because she now asked for a lawyer. So they can't keep interviewing her. And they're like, well, let her leave and we'll compile more evidence. And so they decide to speak with Matthew's friend and family next, right? Like, this is normally what happens in an investigation. It's just that they already have a confession at this point. Also, they'll easily know because if she's saying all the stuff and no friends or family have heard about it, the likelihood of this being true is like 1%. Right? Like, I mean, yeah, if you are struggling with mental health, usually family to this severe of seeing demons, usually somebody else knows. Usually it's not just the spouse, therapist, family, somebody. Somebody. Not always, but usually. So they start interviewing friends and family. They're like, hey, tell us everything you know about Melissa and Matthew. And to them, it's becoming more and more clear that Melissa's story is likely a bunch of bullshit. Now, not only do police learn there is actually no evidence that Matthew has ever considered or tried to self-harm, but when Matthew's brother Sean and his parents hear about his murder, they literally tell police, Melissa killed him, and it wasn't an accident, it was an intentional. Which is a major red flag. It's a family's first reaction is, eh, she killed him, she did it on purpose. Take Melissa down, there's no question in their mind, because they say Melissa, quote, took Maddie long before she took him forever. Like they say she took Matt from them long before she killed him. I guess Matthew had cut off his family sometime prior to his death, which was likely at her demands. Even Sean, his boss, and his brother said that 6 months prior to the murder, he himself had gotten into a fight with Melissa, Matthew's girl. And from what I can tell, it had to do with how many hours Matthew was working for Sean. So she actually got him to quit, and Matthew and Sean hadn't really been speaking much since. So, she says he's working too much, and then he quits his job that he had with his brother. She sounds diabolical. But there is more to the story, according to Matthew's parents. Apparently, Matthew had gotten involved in Melissa's business, one that caused him to slip into old habits and threatened his sobriety. Because remember how I mentioned Melissa was really into cosplay? Well, what I didn't tell you was that was actually how she made a lot of her money. She would dress up like characters and then film sexually explicit content as these characters. And apparently she got Matthew to star in these videos alongside her. Melissa actually started this sexual cosplay blog years prior, and it was supposed to be temporary, a way for her to pay the bills while she found her footing as either an actress or a special effects or makeup artist. But over time, Melissa developed a pretty hefty fan base, people who were willing to pay a lot of money to see their favorite fictional characters come to life and engage in sexual acts, which meant more people willing to pay for her content as well. Now, I'm not sure if this was like an OnlyFans thing, but I know this cam girl job actually helped her buy that home that they lived in Tampa. But even long before she met Matthew and recruited him to participate in her videos, people saw a change in the Melissa they once knew. So before Matt's even in the picture, people who knew Melissa were starting to feel weird. An ex-boyfriend of Melissa's said that once she started to see some real growth and success from her cosplay business, the more unhinged she became. In fact, he said Melissa became so obsessed with her business that it consumed every corner of her life. All she thought about was how to make more and more money, and she was willing to do anything to make that happen. It was almost like something switched inside of Melissa, almost like she became manic. Unpredictable. Now, a former roommate of Matthew's even comes forward to say, look, he didn't live with an alcohol addiction, yes, but Matthew was never violent when he was drunk. Friends and family came forward and they're like, I've lived with him, I've seen him, I partied with him, he was not a violent drunk. However, it did make Melissa pretty angry, according to friends and family, when Matthew got too intoxicated, to the point where multiple people said they had seen her to be the aggressor. So Matthew's family has a different theory for police. They think at first, Matthew might have been in the idea of helping Melissa out with her cosplay stuff, that the cut and the money he would make was probably enticing, and if he didn't work for his brother, he could work for her. But over time, he might have gotten uncomfortable with it, or suggested that he wanted out, and they believe that was the conversation that might have sparked their argument on October 18th. They also wonder if Melissa was actually looking for a partner for her business when she found Matthew on Tinder. Like, Matthew was in shape, he was handsome, fit the mold of a good-looking actor, so maybe Melissa had kind of recruited him in a way to help her out with this content. Of course, this is just the family's theory, but I think it makes sense. I mean, family does know the nuances of a relationship better than we, as people just researching this. And when police hear all of this, they seem to think it kind of makes sense too. The family brings forward enough evidence of this theory that they start to buy it, particularly reflecting back on one thing Melissa said in that interview. and it was that Matthew claimed to be possessed by demons. Now, Melissa is a cosplay model and actress, and a lot of the stuff she does is horror and fantasy related. So they have to wonder, is this like a script for Melissa? Is she creating her own narrative here? And is she giving the performance of her life while doing so? Because not a day later, on October 19th, 2019, Melissa is arrested for second-degree murder with a weapon. She is arrested fairly fast, and a judge sets her bond for $500,000. And Melissa puts that home she shared with Matthew up as collateral, $2 million. Okay, finally, on November 7th, 2019, the autopsy report comes back with some interesting information. It says that the stab wounds on Matthew's back were, in fact, superficial, which was going to be tough for the prosecution, because it suggested that maybe Melissa was telling the truth about trying to get Matthew off her, that the stab was gentle, if you will. They also discovered that Matthew's blood alcohol level was, and this was in quotes in some sources, astronomical. It was actually 5 times over the legal limit for Florida. However, police never checked Melissa's blood alcohol level. Police never checked Melissa's blood alcohol level, so there's no telling if she was equally as incapacitated during this fight. Ultimately, they find the cut to Matthew's right bicep severed an artery that led to his real cause of death, which was from blood loss, which means if Melissa had just called 911 at the time of the fight, they might have been able to stop the bleeding and save Matthew's life. So because of COVID, it takes 2.5 years for Melissa to end up in court. But before that, there are several attempts by both the defense and the state to make some sort of plea. But Melissa maintains it was self-defense. So when the state says 25 years in a state Florida prison for her plea, her attorneys are like, absolutely not. They will plead for 5 years and the state's like, no way. So on Valentine's Day, 2022, it is time for a jury to decide whether Melissa acted in self-defense or not. Because it's not a question of whether she killed him. So after hearing some of this, I still think, let's say my opinion, I don't think it was in self-defense. But I don't know how that can be proven. So I think she's going to get off, because after hearing the evidence you have, unless there's more while we go into the trial, I just don't see how she gets convicted. So let me tell you a little bit about the trial. The judge did not allow any mention of Melissa's cosplay career to enter the courtroom. According to them, it wasn't relevant to the case. I always find it interesting when a judge is like, yeah, this isn't relevant. It's like, everything is relevant. Like, I understand that, like, the jury might look at her differently if they knew what she did for a living. But that's part of the case, right? I mean, it doesn't really technically tie into the killing that night. So he's just worried about the preconceived ideas around it. I think the family thinks it does because the family thinks he was leaving and that's what bothered her. But I think it could be helpful for the jury to know that this woman is technically an actress. Like, she's an aspiring actress. She acts in these videos. There's a chance she could cry on demand, because right away, she goes on to give the jury her sob story about how she thought she was going to die that night, and she had no choice but to act in self-defense. She was never intended to kill Matthew, and yes, she does take the stand during her own trial. Frankly, the defense had a pretty good chance at getting these charges dismissed. Between the superficial stab wounds, the extremely high blood alcohol content, they argued that could make someone hallucinate and see demons. Like, her story could be true. And Melissa painting Matthew as an abusive alcoholic who exhibited unsettling past behavior, that's a hard case to fight. And maybe one of the most interesting things that kind of helped her case was in regard to that security footage from the neighbor's home. And I know you would think it would be the opposite. This is the one where you can hear Melissa screaming obscenities at Matthew and telling him to die. Well, the defense actually calls a former FBI audio expert to the stand, and they say they're pretty sure sections of the audio have been edited and the volume enhanced at trial to make Melissa sound loud and Matthew practically inaudible. Now, I don't know if this is true. Obviously, like, an FBI expert is testifying to it. I don't know if the audio was edited. What I do know, though, is that it is very obvious on that audio that Melissa is telling Matthew to die. I mean, you can't edit that, and that is the truth. And also, I mean, this also could just be the reality of the situation. In the audio, Melissa was the aggressor. Matthew could have been stabbed. He could have been trying to calm things down. Or he was already so injured at that point that he couldn't scream. I mean, ultimately, it was up to the jury to sift through this massive pile of fact and fiction. But I want to say, it didn't take long for one thing to become clear. And that was that Melissa wasn't that good of an actress after all. Excuse me. Melissa tried to cry on the stand. 1 minute on the stand, she would be really angry, and then just like that, flip a switch and be devastatingly sad. and this really made the jurors feel uncomfortable. But that was only the tip of the iceberg when it came to proving Melissa's guilt, because the prosecution brought up another questionable point in Melissa's story. Remember when she said Matthew had hit her head on the counter and that's when she stumbled and passed out? Well, when she was examined at the crime scene that day, a tech determined that she had zero signs of head injury. And if that was the case, why didn't she report it right away to the police? Well, the answer to that question seemed to come with one final smoking gun. It was another piece of tape that was shown to the jury from inside the couple's home on the night of the attack. It's from an ADT surveillance camera pointed at the couple's foyer. So they had a camera inside the house. It's 3:42 a.m., and you can see Matthew walking through their foyer pretty calmly. Everything about his demeanor is pretty normal. And then Melissa is trailing him behind him in this footage, and she's hunched over. She looks irate. She's disheveled. She's very intoxicated. And she's almost like creepily stalking Matthew into the kitchen, where according to the timeline, their fight begins less than 20 minutes later. And then at 4:08 a.m., Melissa returns into frame and she's standing in the foyer, just staring at the wall for a moment. In that clip, you can see that her right hand is covered in blood. And then Melissa turns back, walks back into the kitchen. Now there are so many alarm bells going off with these tapes, but one of the biggest things that prosecutors point out at the trial is, okay, if she's in self-defense, right, and she's in distress, she feels like her life is on the line here, like she's claiming, why would you get out of the kitchen where the fight is happening and then go back in? And then like calmly and then run back in. I think it's pretty clear to say that Melissa probably did not get hit in the head and stumble into her office, and that she could have easily called 911 in that moment if her life was in danger. But she was either so drunk she couldn't comprehend what was happening, or she chose not to. So after less than a week of testimony, the jury came back on February 18th, 2022 with a verdict. 29-year-old Melissa Turner was found guilty of second-degree murder. She was later sentenced to 20 and a half years behind bars, but the damage Melissa did to Matthew's family and his memory was unrepairable. Matthew's mother pointed out how Melissa not only isolated him from them in the final months of his life, she created this narrative of abuse about him. She slaughtered his name after killing him, which is what I was saying earlier. She just made all this crap up. I mean, she used Matthew's hardest battles, his alcoholism, his addiction, as a way to try and throw him under the bus, to shield him, herself, to protect herself, to cover up the fact that she did murder him, and according to the state, willingly did it as second-degree murder. When I think in reality, Melissa was probably the threat all along. If you're basing it off what everyone in their life has said, yeah, it feels like pretty cut and dry behavior. Isolate someone from their family, isolate them from their job, completely cut them off, make them rely on you. That feels like aggressive or aggressor predatory behavior to me. It's pretty wild. And that's honestly the case of Matthew Tressler and where it's sitting now. Let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. Don't forget, you can find us on all major podcast platforms, including Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, everywhere you get your podcast from. With that, thank you so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time.